journalism and kind of panic-stricken journalism or panic-inducing journalism around wildfire. And once again, it comes back to that fundamental piece that it is a natural phenomenon that is going to happen in this area, and we need to be able to tell that story in a calm, responsible, measured way.
Yeah, I think what I'm hearing from that is that obviously it's important to address like the suffering that it can cause, but then also to not address it and come at it with this level of alarmism or ascribing the fires to one specific cause in particular and not considering, I guess, a more holistic approach to reporting on it.
Yeah, I think I deal with the fire all the time. It's my day job, quite literally. And the complexities of fire blow me away all the time. The complexities of the trade-offs needed to address it, and the complexities of how you respond to an emergency. And I think that, I mean, complexities are a really difficult thing to communicate publicly. That's the standard challenge in journalism, from my understanding. And fire is such a key element of that. And then I think the other piece is simply recognizing that things aren't going to be perfect. A fire is a natural event that causes huge strain, puts huge stress on responders, and decisions aren't always going to be perfect. And we can't recognize the presence of a big fire in BC as a failure of government or a failure in suppression. It's simply the way it is sometimes. And yeah, I think journalism has got a lot better about fires. When I started this, we never used to hear solutions-based journalism about fires. We never heard anything about cultural burning, and now every year those are part of the conversation. So I think it's teaching, helping a generation of journalists learn how to cover this story, and especially when you bring in the factors of climate change and how we talk about that. But at the same time, it's also helping an agency that has largely operated in remote forested areas all of a sudden deal with this intense media scrutiny and intense media landscape. And so that work, I think, is somewhat unfinished, but I do hope that the journalism report or the journalism boot camp might have helped at least provide a useful guide to those that are having to tell the story.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's very, very important work and being able to effectively communicate something that is affecting everyone, not just in BC, but like throughout Canada, in the United States, in Europe, as well. Those were the main questions I had for this interview, but if there are any other, I guess, upcoming or current projects of the Mitigating Wildfire Initiative that we didn't touch on that you'd want to speak on, what would that be?
Well, thanks for the questioner. We actually tend to wind down our operations a lot in the summer, and the reason is a lot of the people we would work with are really, really busy right now. So, rather than Yeah, I don't really have anything direct to promote at the moment, but I think the biggest thing I would highlight is just the importance of preparation and recognizing that if you live in British Columbia, you live in a fire-prone ecosystem, and just recognizing that this is something that at the very least you need to be aware of, and at the very least you need to understand could happen. And so just when it comes to emergency planning and the documents and knowing what you would do, just spend 10 minutes and have a think about that. That's all I can really ask at the moment.
Once again, that was our conversation with James Whitehead, the Special Projects Manager for the Mitigating Wildfire Initiative at SFU, that is working towards creating new preventative solutions for addressing wildfires throughout BC. This has been Danny Nesvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM. This segment would not have been possible without the continued support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada's Local Journalism Initiative. You can also find this piece on frequencynews.ca. Once again, that was my interview with James Whitehead of the Mitigating Wildfire Initiative here at SFU. Hope you enjoyed listening to that. Before we get on to the next news piece of the hour, we're going to be taking another music break with a band by the name of Strawberry Punch that we had here recently at CJSF for a Studio 6 session, our in-studio or in-station sessions, where we get a band to come in and perform live, and then we air it straight to air. It's not up yet on our YouTube channel, but once it is, we will let you know. And yeah, tune into their music. This one is titled Jane off of their album Strawberry Punch by the band Strawberry Punch.
Is Bird Note. tides partway out. Bonaparte's gulls, one of North America's smallest, have formed a chorus line at the water's edge. Side by side, in half an inch of water, they're stomping their feet as fast as they can. This stirs up an abundance of tiny marine invertebrates, including a smorgasbord of shrimp. Is this a learned behavior, or are the gulls born knowing how to forage cooperatively? Most likely, it's innate, but no one knows for certain. The Bonaparte's gulls have returned from the boreal forest of the north, where they nest in trees. Trees? Yes, they're the only gull that regularly does that. Now, as they migrate south through the Mississippi Flyway and along both coasts, they're amassing in large flocks. The head of the adult is still black, like a vanilla cone that's been dipped in very dark chocolate. But soon, it will begin a gradual transition back to the white head of winter. This is one gull you're never going to see in a garbage dump. Bonapartes find food in several ways, but not by picking through trash. Why should they, when they have such a nutritional dance routine? To share today's show with a friend, begin at our website, birdnote.org. I'm Michael Stein.
You're tuned in to Speak Up, only on CJSF 90.1 FM. Coming up next, we have a report from our friends at CHLY in Nanaimo. Take a listen.
This is a CHLY news update. The Insurance Corporation of British Columbia, ICBC, has announced that starting October 19th, drivers with Class 7 or 8 novice licenses and a clean driving record will not need a second road test to acquire their Class 5. British Columbia's graduated licensing program, GLP, was first introduced more than 25 years ago. ICBC said it was time to update the requirements to align with BC's evolving roads and safety practices, joining the rest of Canada in removing the second road test. This leaves only Ontario as the only province with the second road test still in place. According to the province of BC, the changes are intended to get new drivers more road experience to reduce crash risk. Jeffrey Neer, instructor and owner of the Vancouver Island Driving School, commented on the changes to the driving licensing process.
The Class 5 test is virtually the same driver's test that they take to get their N. So if you passed it once, I'm pretty sure you're going to pass it again 2 years later. It was almost something that was a waste of time to begin with, in my opinion.
Neer adds that drivers will still have to maintain a clean driving record for at least 12 months before becoming eligible to remove their novice license, noting that even a speeding ticket will reset the eligibility period until they complete a full year without any infractions. ICBC states that the decision to remove the second road test was in part to reduce barriers to licensing, specifically for drivers in rural, remote, or Indigenous communities where access to road tests may be scarce. Neer gives his opinion on the removal of the second test for new drivers.
I think it's a good thing to get rid of the second test because, like I say, the kids have already taken the same test and passed it to get their new driver's license. So I feel like if you can pass it when you've only been driving for a year, then certainly you'd be able to pass it after having an extra 2 years of experience.
He also believes the changes also likely to reduce pressure on the province's road testing system, adding that many drivers currently wait several months to secure a testing appointment because of demand. Drivers under 25 with a Class 7L learner's license must complete at least 12 months of supervised driving before taking the Class 7 road test. After earning their Class 7 new driver's license, they must hold it for a minimum of 25 months before becoming eligible for a driver's record assessment, or 18 months if they have completed an approved GLP course. Drivers age 25 and older must spend at least 9 months with a Class 7L before taking the Class 7 road test. They are then required to hold their Class 7 license for a minimum of 12 months with no suspensions or driving prohibitions before applying for a driving record assessment. Eligible drivers who pass the assessment will receive a Class 5 license, with a 12-month restriction requiring zero blood alcohol and blood drug content while driving. Once that restriction period ends without any incidents, they will receive a full Class 5 license. Neer says he will not change how he teaches his students in the future.
I don't just teach the kids how to pass the driver's test. I teach all the important things about driving. For example, they don't make them merge onto a highway on a driver's test, but I'm certainly going to continue teaching that because these are all the things that keep you safe.
Drivers eligible for a Class 5 upgrade with restrictions will receive a letter from ICBC confirming their eligibility. ICBC stated that any outstanding debts would affect the upgrade. The second road test will officially be eliminated as of October 19th, 2026. If there was a second road test booked for or after the date, ICBC would automatically cancel it and email the appointees. Further information on acquiring your driving records is available on the ICBC website. For CHOY in Nanaimo, this is Luis Sabla.
This report was made with the support of the Local Journalism Initiative, the Community Radio Fund of Canada, and listeners like you. You can find more news updates, interviews, and stories from our nonprofit newsroom, as well as our news and current affairs podcast, Midcoast Morning, at chly.ca/news.
Thank you again to Luis Sabla and CHLY for that news piece. Ending off today, here's an interview that I did with SFU academic Jen Marchbank. Reporting from Surrey, BC, this is Danny Nesvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM. At Simon Fraser University Surrey campus, a presentation was hosted by Professor of Gender, Sexuality, and Women's Studies, Jen Marchbank. The presentation showcased Marchbank's newest project, a collection of oral history interviews from the 2S LGBTQ plus community of Surrey for the purpose of creating a digital archive. As stated by Marchbank during her presentation, the queer history in places such as Surrey that reside on the periphery of larger cities like Vancouver are often overlooked. The project aims to combat this by sharing the lived experiences of 2S LGBTQ plus people throughout Surrey. To learn more about the project, what it entails, and when it will be released, we sat down for an interview with Jen Marchbank. Please take a listen.
Well, hi, I'm Jen Marchbank. I'm currently the department chair in the Department of Gender, Sexuality, and Women's Studies. This project is Telling Our Stories, a Queer Oral History of Surrey, BC. It's part of various projects that I have conducted since about 2010 in Surrey in terms of things like doing public histories.
And what spurred you to pursue this project in particular? What was the motivation behind it?
Well, one of the motivations behind it is that I feel that here in North America, we kind of privilege certain cities as being metro cities with safe and active around 2S LGBTQ activities, etc. And I felt that Surrey has not been fully represented in that, and especially important because Surrey is actually the place where we got a Supreme Court decision on school materials being acceptable through James Chamberlain's advocacy, and also the HIV travel ban removed through the advocacy of a man called Martin Rooney. So they were both Surrey residents when they did these important national and international legal changes. And so some of the work I've been doing in the past is to ensure that their voices have been recorded, that they have been, when I did a museum exhibit a couple of years ago at the Museum of Surrey, they were the kind of anchors for that exhibit. But also I want to make sure that we don't just hear about the crises in 2S LGBTQ lives, right? Or we don't want to just hear about people like me who are activists. We get our voice out there. I wanted to record people who connect to Surrey in some way and who just want to talk and identify under the umbrella in some way. I just say to them, here is an opportunity. We have some guiding questions, but please, what story do you want to tell? So some people have told stories about being an activist. Martin Rooney told us the HIV travel ban story. We've had other people talking about running queer youth groups. And some people just about, hey, I grew up in Surrey and I happen to be non-binary.
Yeah, and how have you decided or chosen who to speak to? How does that work? Is it an outreach process or are people coming to you saying, hey, I want to be a part of this archive?
It was publicized on social media and through various networks. But we also last year certain people we reached out to, most definitely, right? And we said, we need you to come and speak about this, please, this, please, this, please. So one of them was, we wanted to have someone who worked in media. So we reached out to Mike Keeping and said, talk about OutTV and the work you do there and all the other work you've done over the years. But we got people who volunteered themselves, or someone would come in and be interviewed and said, you need to speak to so-and-so, I'll get them to contact you. And we put out there our telling our stories one at gmail.com email address, so people could do that. We had a booth at the Surrey Pride Festival last summer. And again, that was another way of reaching people. I was really keen to reach people. Yes, there are certain people's voices that have stories have to be told, but I also wanted to say, those are not the only voices. And so people who I know who've been involved in previous projects, I asked them to talk about something different if they were in my project.
Another thing that I think is interesting is you talk a lot about, you know, the way in which cities that sort of neighbor these big metropolitan areas, such as the city of Vancouver, are often overlooked when it comes to queer representation and queer history, but, you know, no matter what city you're going to go to or look into, there are going to be queer people there. So there is always going to be something to talk about, some level of history that is worth documenting. But I guess I'm curious, because it does feel like the city of Surrey in particular has had this reputation of being less progressive and less open and less accommodating for queer folks. And I'm wondering if part of this project is trying to dispel some of that, or even just share the stories of people that are in Surrey and maybe are struggling with their identity.
Okay, so part of this project was when I came to Surrey and I looked around, and that was 20 years ago. And the very first thing I collected, I decided that I needed to do some public history work, and I started collecting T-shirts and mugs and things like that from various Surrey Pride festivals. I started an excellent relationship with City of Surrey Archives back in 2018. This is a story I told yesterday, that I was at an event. I was on an SFU history panel. I mentioned that I had an archive in my office. And that started my relationship with the City of Surrey Archivists. And that's an ongoing, really positive relationship. Heritage Surrey have been fantastic. I also developed some excellent relationships with the museum curators. And over the years, I have been part of three exhibit curations. And my archive stimulated a couple of other people to say, oh, what about me? I can give you this. So share. Alex, Amar Sanger and Martin Rooney donated their materials, which meant that when the City of Surrey does its open house days, you know, where you can go in and look at displays at City Hall, at Stewart Farm, or in the museum or the archives, those materials are available. So one, yes, is to make visible to that person who might be saying, I don't know anybody else, I don't feel validated, I really do feel representation matters. So there's that. But also I want to make sure that there's an accurate recording of who's doing what where. And I also think that if people know that this is going on in Surrey, they won't feel the need to always move to another metropolis. I mean, we are a huge city with a great history of activism. It's a slightly different activism. And people are always surprised. You know, when I say to them, June 20th is the 27th Surrey Pride Festival, they go like, what? People still say things like, I didn't know Surrey had a Pride, because we're shadowed by Vancouver. But these days, so, you know, since moving into the Lower Mainland, Delta has a Pride picnic. Langley has a Pride Day. Langley's got a Silver Pride, which is for queer seniors. So there's been those, and there's, you know, the Fraser Valley Pride Society, you know, all the way from Delta to Chilliwack, that are groups of people organising to provide social events, support, information sharing, all those kind of things. You know, they're not just geography based. You know, we have Pinoy Pride for the Filipino community, Share Pride for South Asians and their allies. They're very active. So there's a lot going on. And if we only look around and say, well, Vancouver has a big parade, then we're missing a large part of the picture.
So it sounds like this project is sort of contributing to the effort of representing Surrey's queer community as a whole in a way that maybe it hasn't been.
It's not representing and saying that this is a microcosm of it. It's about, you know, here are the people who are willing to be put on video. So there's a whole lot, that's a whole barrier to a number of people. So I'm not saying that I've got a representative sample in the way that social scientists work with that, but it is putting more voices out there. And at this stage, it is simply gathering the stories. So gathering the stories via Surrey Pride Society, which will then donate them to that city archives. But also we're transcribing into French and English and Punjabi. So this is going to be a resource for anybody who wants to say, I'm just Googling around to find something. Oh, that seems interesting. I think we'll get a few visits from people from England because there's a confusion between Surrey, BC and Surrey, England. Quite often get Surrey Pride events. We go, no, we're Surrey, BC. But I think we'll be able to get, you know, people will be able to look from around the world and see what these stories are and maybe use them for their own research projects or their high school homework.
Yeah, it's a great resource that you're building.
Well, I haven't analysed it at all yet because I want it to be complete, and then maybe I'm going to be writing about the methodology of it, the process, by oral history and by oral histories and queers in different places. But at the moment, you know, what will go out is unedited. We told all of our participants that what you say will go out completely unedited unless you ask us to make a particular edit.
Right.
You know, someone names somebody and goes, oops, maybe I shouldn't have done that. We'll blank out that name.
And yeah, you mentioned that it's going to be translated in three different languages, English, French, and Punjabi, which obviously that makes a lot of sense considering the demographics of Surrey. Is that something that is also that you want to represent in the people that are spoken to as well?
Yes, absolutely. And what we've done is, 10 years ago, I did another project, which was raising awareness about elder abuse in the 2S LGBTQ community. And I did that with Claire Robson and Gloria Gutman, both of SFU. We found that the translations we got when we put our posters into Punjabi were a little bit stilted because there was no queer language. So it was, the words were like women who love women rather than any term that meant lesbian. So it was a little bit not what we wanted. So this time round, we've identified a queer Punjabi translator. So who will use the language that is currently being used in Punjabi to describe identities and relationships that fall under this rainbow banner. So we wanted it to actually speak to queer South Asians as well.
Mm, for sure.
And we have had people being interviewed there as well.
So one of the last questions I had for you was just, when can people begin to access these archives, if there is a timeline for this project?
There is a timeline. We want the final interviews will hopefully be before July. The transcribing is currently going on, and that transcribing will include English subtitles on all of them so that there's access for people who have hearing disabilities. So we will have English subtitles along the bottom. Then we're aiming for a September launch. So that will be a public event in Surrey in September, where people will be invited to come and view. You know, we'll have some TV screens up and we'll be showing little clips of different things. And just we'll invite everybody who has participated and those who have supported the project. And we will have an event.
Once again, that was my interview with Jen Marchbank on the archive that she's currently creating of 2S LGBTQ stories for people living in the city of Surrey. That is all we have for today's episode of Speak Up. But make sure you tune in tomorrow for Intravenous with our public affairs and talk coordinator, Nicole Hines. This week on Intravenous, Nicole is planning on having some guests in studio, starting off with UBC midwifery professor Dr. Vedam, who led the national study RESP-CCT and Linda Yock, Learning Events and Outreach Coordinator with Seniors First BC. Democracy Now! Coming your way right
now. Hi, I'm Amy